Hi, this is Dan Eastman with the Eastman Financial Report. I'm your host today. Moved to new digs. I have to apologize for the technical glitches we had yesterday. Somewhat unexplainable, but in the middle of my boring economics lecture, I seem to have disappeared into the ether. But I'm back today, and I wanted to continue our discussion of inflation and how it impacts on all of us as consumers and mere citizens of the United States, and how the big players in the economy tend to be setting the tone, and we're reacting. So I wanted to bring some of these ideas to highlight and talk about those. I was noticing today that inflation, of course, is the topic that we really want to drill down on. One of the stories I saw was that subprime car loans are decidedly deteriorating. And maybe we can talk about that and explain what that all means. In the automobile industry, people who buy automobiles, and of course that's most of us, are ranked according to credit score as to your ability to buy a car and to effectively afford the monthly payments. And if your credit score isn't the best and you end up in a subprime category, you end up paying a higher interest rate and maybe a longer term loan amortization period than you would otherwise. And that class of automobile buyers tends to be lower income. And of course, they're classified as subprime borrowers. Well, as you can imagine, if you're on the if your income is tight and your credit isn't so good, the ability to afford a car payment becomes difficult, because what is sold as a convenient monthly payment sometimes and always becomes rather a burden. When your income fluctuates, you lose your job, your hours are cut, whatever, it gets harder to make those payments. And in any type of economic downturn, you're going to find that level of borrower deteriorating first. So when you see news stories that talk about subprime car loan defaults increasing, and we're looking at a 6% increase in the deterioration of that loan portfolio, that's significant, because while it's 6% of the people are struggling, and I guess 94% aren't, but at the end of the day, what it's telling you is that inflation is having an effect on people's budgets, and you're starting to see these deteriorate indicators showing up in items like this. So let's think what happens if you're in that situation. Well, you know, we know that gasoline, depending which state you're living in, is $3, $4 a gallon, could be higher, $5. And gasoline's expensive. And of course, automobiles need gasoline to propel them. So what you're seeing is, if it's costing you $40 or $50 or $60 to fill up your gas tank, that expenditure competes with your grocery bill. And of course, we look at the now proverbial $8 eggs, which was at the store yesterday, they're only $6. But the point is, eggs have gone up, milk has gone up, food has gone up. And those are competing interests. You either eat or you have gas for your car. In any event, your income is not going up at the same rate as these other items that you're buying. So what happens is, to all of us, but unfortunately to people in the subprime category, they feel the pinch of that inflation immediately. And if you're a high income person or high wealth person, you're going to find that you have a little bit of running room. And of course, you're no happier to spend $50 on a tank than anyone else, a tank of gas. But you know, you can absorb it. But when you're on the lower end of the spectrum, that gets to be a little hard to do. So we think about that and what it tells you for the economy, that as the Federal Reserve continues to push these interest rate increases in an attempt to fight inflation, going out to buy a new car, of course, is going to be more expensive, because you're going to end up with a higher interest rate. And it puts you in a box. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to consider about the automobile industry in general is that one thing I've noticed, and it's been sort of surprising, is that the price of cars continue to go up. When you look at how much a car loan costs, one statistic I saw shows that, you know, the average car payment is approaching $700 a month. That used to be rent, that used to be a house payment, but now it's a monthly payment for an automobile. And the question is, why? Well, we have inflation in the auto markets, and prices of steel go up, and rubber, and vinyl and whatever else goes into the makings of a car, wires and pipes and valves and all sorts of things. So the price of cars are going up. But one of the things I notice as I'm driving my car is that the number of digital enhancements in these new cars get to be, you wonder about the price value ratio of the constant and increasing digitalization of an automobile. To give you an example, in my car, won't mention any names, they're not sponsors of this program, but anyway, I have a nice car, and it's a middle-of-the-road type of car, but it has all sorts of electronic features that I didn't ask for, I doubt anybody else asked for, but unfortunately, it's built into the price. Like these systems that, while you're driving the car, it constantly beeps at you if you shift in your driving lane. You get too close to one side or the other, it beeps at you. Another remarkable feature that I find totally useless is the cruise control settings. In the old days, you'd put your cruise control on at 70 miles an hour and follow the law, and you're cruising along the highway, and you come up behind somebody who's driving a little slower. And your natural instincts as a rational thinking human being is, well, you know, I'll check my left lane, and if it's clear, I'll change lanes, I'll pass the slower driver, and I'll pull back into my lane and keep moving right along at 70 miles an hour. It's a decision, it's a choice. Well, these new systems, you know, basically what happens is it adjusts your car speed. So as you're driving along at 70 miles an hour with the cruise on, you're coming up to a slower driving vehicle, it slows the car down. And of course, you know, what it does is these systems are telling you that you're no longer intelligent enough to slow your own car down, change lanes, pass, or you're no longer intelligent enough to stay within the white lines. Now you got these, you know, these robot systems that are doing all this stuff for you. And I don't know that anybody's asked for that. So the systems cost a lot of money because they're effectively artificial intelligence. And if you look at how automobiles are competing with the Tesla phenomenon, everybody is apparently in a great big race to get to a car where you can sit in the driver's seat and read a newspaper or an iPad, and your car will whisk you along in a chauffeur-driven experience, and you don't have to have any input. Well, that's an interesting end game, but In society, we would expect that people who operate motor vehicles have to have some level of competence. I mean, you take a driver's test, and you got to take a written test and a behind the wheel test. There's this idea that if you're going to undertake the operation of a motor vehicle on the highways and byways of America, that you have some level of competence to operate the system. So all of these systems cost money. And if you look at the price of cars, you're seeing cars into the $40,000, $50,000 range because they got all these bells and whistles. Just like these electronic keys. In the olden days, you'd have a car key. You know, and you get in your car, you put it in there, you turn your car on, you're driving along, and you always knew where your key was, okay? And when you're done, you park, you turn your key off, put it back in your pocket, your purse, whatever, you leave. I don't know that anybody's asked for these systems with when you walk up to your car, the door unlocks, and you know, you're sitting in the car, and the car starts when you push the button. All of that costs a lot of money. And these convenience factors are driving up the price of automobiles. And I'm not sure that anybody asked for that. You know, I get these surveys from the auto companies from time to time, and I don't recall ever saying, you know, I'd like my car to automatically slow down. I'd like it to crab at me if I'm drifting in my lane. And I don't want to have a car key, so the thing could just start, you know, when I appear and turn off. Nobody asked for any of that stuff. So, in effect, all of these features are adding a cost to cars. So you start to think about that. And, you know, for folks who make a good living and have wealth, that's fine. Boy, they would be nothing cooler than to really have a digitally chauffeured limousine that would pick me up and haul me. And there's no chauffeur. It's just, you know, robots. And it would take me somewhere. And that'd be cool. But you know, for the average person who just wants to get into a vehicle and drive somewhere, that's a lot of money. So the question is, you know, where is the Volkswagen of today? You know, back in the olden days, you know, after World War II, the German economy was trying to right itself after the war. And the idea was that there'd be a car available for everyone. And Volkswagen started to happen. You look at the American market with Chevrolet and Ford. You know, these are cars for the average person. You buy a car, it takes you hither and yon. And at the end of the day, they were simple to use, simple to operate, and they were cheap so that people could afford it. But as we see this technological push, pushing technology within automobiles, you're going to end up at a point where the average person may not be able to afford a car, or you'll be affording a used car, which of course has the mechanical problems and you know other things. So when I see this, you know, this news story that says that, you know, subprime auto loans are 6% higher in default than they were last month, it really creates a question as to why that is and why there aren't, you know, proletarian cars that are cheap on the road and, you know, good on gas, and you don't have to have all the bells and whistles if you don't want them. You know, sometimes I always think of Warren Buffett living in his 3-bedroom ranch. I always admired the guy. You know, he could live in any mansion on the face of the earth. And here's old Warren, you know, holed up in his 3-bedroom ranch in Omaha. You know, that's a comforting thought, because, you know, you don't, just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you want to waste it or spend it. So anyway, so enough complaining about the auto business, but I think it's an indicator to watch, because what it tells us is inflation is having an impact. Gasoline prices, automobile prices, I'm sure auto service costs are going up as well. So it's something that we need to be paying attention to. Another interesting article that I noticed in today's news is that the retail spending number comes out monthly. And what that does is it calculates how much money is spent in American retail outlets, online, brick and mortar. And of course, we watch that because it's an indicator of economic health. We would like to see lots and lots of retail spending happening, and the number should go up every month. And, you know, it shows a robust economy where people are making money and they're comfortable buying things and they're spending money. And I think that's a healthy indicator of where we are in the economy. But I noticed in January there was glowing headlines that the retail rates in January had gone up. And then that's a happy thing, because we like to see people spending. But then you have to ask the question, is it more volume of goods, or are the retail numbers higher because the prices are higher? You get the same number of products going out the door. Is it because the prices are higher due to inflation, or are they just selling more stuff at the same price? I would submit, ladies and gentlemen, that inflation is driving those numbers along. Now we look at the February numbers, and lo and behold, the experts are predicting they were supposed to go up by 0.4%. They only went up by 0.3%. So the headlines scream that retail spending is collapsing. Well, I don't know if it's collapsing or not, but what it does tell you is that if retail sales begin to soften and interest rates for loans like car loans and mortgages are continuing to increase, all of that is suggesting that there's an inflationary deterioration going on with the number of dollars people have to spend. Unfortunately, when inflation goes up, wages don't always track to the same percentage. I remember back in the 1970s when President Nixon took the U.S. dollar off the gold standard, the inflation rate in the United States exploded, because what happened was that the gold was pegged at $35 per ounce after World War II. And I think I'd mentioned this yesterday. And that was the Bretton Woods Agreement that kept the dollar very stable. And that's why it became pegged as the world currency. It was also used to transact oil transactions because of its global stability and power. Well, once you detether that from a gold standard or any type of commodity standard or land-based standard, you end up with an inflationary ability, because as you pump more dollars into the system, you're creating inflation. And you ask, all right, so how do they do that? How do they get more dollars into the system? Well, we look at the situation today and the situation in Ukraine, where the federal government is spending a lot of money, $200 billion plus, sending assets and money and equipment and whatever they're sending is $200 billion that they've had to issue federal bonds to fund. And of course, who buys the bonds? Well, I don't know that the Russians are going to be buying the bonds to buy the tanks to send over to Russia. I think they may pass on that offering. The Chinese, they also buy a lot of bonds. Who knows? That's all international, you know, intrigue. But one thing is for certain, that the Federal Reserve of the United States, which is not a government agency, by the way, Federal Reserve is a private entity that is owned and controlled by the banking by the banking interests, and it's designated by the charter to create and control and monitor the monetary supply. Okay, so the feds will basically, effectively, if the bonds don't sell within the reasonable rate, the interest rates that are prevalent today in the market, the Federal Reserve steps in and buys those bonds to keep the rates, the interest rates from going crazy. And effectively, it monetizes the national debt. Now, that was a big deal back in 2008. Before that time, the Federal Reserve issued bonds or bought bonds in the marketplace to control the supply of money. And they did that through a mechanism, it's called the open market desk, and they would buy and sell bonds to keep the interest rates in a very tight band. And that was traditionally how the Federal Reserve was created to operate, that their job was to put, you know, how much money do we need? We put it into the economy, and the economy hums along on the number of dollars floating around in the economy. That's how a central bank operates. And I think one of the famous sayings from professional economists was that, and I can't remember, it was Milton Friedman. It was one of the prominent economists. He said, the Federal Reserve's job is to take away the punch bowl just as the party is getting started. So effectively what that means is the Federal Reserve would regulate the economy and keep these interest rates in a really tight band. Well, when 2008 came along and the wheels basically fell off of the global financial mechanism, the Federal Reserve had to drop in and step into a different role. And we called that quantitative easing. Effectively, what it meant is that the Federal Reserve had to step in and buy bonds because there were no market for bonds. The interest rates were going to infinity. There was just nobody was going to buy a bond because nobody understood how bad the economy or the financial system was. They didn't know if it was collapsing. It was a total meltdown. So the Federal Reserve started to step in and purchase bonds. And as a result of that, it was highly controversial because the Federal Reserve is not supposed to buy stocks to prop up the stock market. It's not supposed to buy bonds to prop up the bond market. The stock market should be a free market. The bond market should be a free market. But here comes the Federal Reserve. And, you know, the policy question is, should we step in and save the world, or should we let the world collapse into a mushroom cloud, a financial mushroom cloud, and pick up the pieces? Well, you know, the government decided. Federal government said, you know, you got to step in here and do something. So there were meetings with the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve, and lo and behold, we have quantitative easing, which now basically allows the Federal Reserve to step in and buy bonds when the federal government can't sell them to anybody else, and keep the interest rates in a band. So when you hear that the Federal Reserve is going to increase the interest rates to 4%, what they're saying is they're going to dial back on their purchasing and allow those bonds to increase in value so others in the market, you know, Chinese, Russians still aren't going to buy the bonds, but others will step in and they'll pay 4% so the Federal Reserve doesn't. So this is the mechanism that they use to basically control the economy. And that's why when we look at all of this going on and it's affecting, you know, the subprime loans, which are higher interest rates to begin with, also retail spending is happening, and also in the housing market, the price of housing, it's amazing. The price of housing is going up and up and up. The supply of people willing to sell their houses, they're not much supply because you don't want to sell your house and end up homeless because you can't find another house or you can't find another house in a price range you can afford. So people are hunkering down and holding on to their housing. So all of this stuff is interconnected. And that's the purpose of my lecture series here, is to try and analyze and translate what's going on so that the average person can figure out what's going on. You know, one of the things about the housing market is that we've seen a phenomenal increase in the amount of private equity that is moving into American housing. It's not only private equity groups, but it is also foreign buyers and foreign investors who see the American economy and the American community as a stable place to park their money. So if you've got a lot of Chinese investors coming in, or individuals that want to buy a home, and you've got people coming out of the southern border, everybody wants to buy a house. And of course, you've got international and national funds that are going around and buying houses. They're all creating demand that is above and beyond the demand created by the average person in America. We have this population that wants to buy a house. And then we are competing with all of these investors that are stepping in, and at the same time, they're buying houses as well. So the price of housing is going up. There's very little supply. There's a lot of demand at a time when interest rates are going up. Well, how can that be? Well, these investors who come in, they're paying cash. They're not taking out mortgages. They're not worried if it's a 4% or 5% or 6% mortgage. They could care less. They have cash, and they can outbid people who have to, you know, qualify for a mortgage, get a letter from their lender, and you know, pay the money. So it puts the Americans, the Native Americans here, at a disadvantage with respect to the ability to compete for a house. And that's why we're seeing housing across the United States going up and up in value. Every time there's a false buyer of a house that has cash, it puts the rest of the market at a disadvantage. So I guess one of the questions, you know, is how do you protect yourself as a citizen from all of these national and international pressures and try to maintain your standard of living and make sure that you're not just swept away in another economic typhoon that they always come. I mean, the economies are secular. They go up and they go down. So how do you protect yourself? Well, as an average person, you need to be looking at things, putting your money in things that other people want. Like, you know, there's a lot of things. If you buy a house, obviously a lot of people want it. If you buy, you know, art or antiques or, you know, gold or precious metals, those are things that have value in the marketplace. So as inflation goes up, the value of those things go up as well. And I'm inclined, we have one of our sponsors here, Swiss America, is a company in the United States that sells gold and precious metals. I would strongly recommend, if you have an interest in buying something that holds value, that you contact these people and ask them for their free packet of information and then read it. I mean, their number, it's a toll-free number. It's 1-800-519-6271. And they're experts, a great rating, and good people. And the idea is, if you want to diversify and you're not going to be able to buy real estate because it's expensive, and maybe you're not into art and antiques, which is kind of a funny market, you may want to take a look at precious metals. And I'll tell you, Swiss America is one of the best players out there. And again, it's 800-519-6271. They're kind enough to sponsor my show. And certainly, if you ought to request the free packet, you should read it, think about it, and then call them with any questions. Do your homework, do your own thinking. But if you think that type of asset is correct, it's right for you, they're the people to call. And really think about it, because if you're in a situation where a wage earning American and you're trying to figure out, you know, why is my car cost so much? Why is gasoline so much? Why are the eggs so much? Why is housing going up? Why are the interest rates going up? Why is the mortgage going up? What are you doing to protect yourself? And traditionally, tangible assets are a great place to be. It's not quite as liquid as, let's say, equities, but you have to diversify your portfolio. So I would recommend you give them a call or at least get the free packet. And, you know, like I said, do your homework and think about it, because at the end of the day, this is, you know, you have the responsibility to take care of yourself. And, you know, it's really important, yourself and your family. And in these turbulent times, we've got some very political things happening in the United States. And, you know, when you look at the news headlines and you look at this whole election fiasco that's gone on since for the last two years plus, it's pretty obvious that the U.S. has some structural problems. We have issues in this country, and you need to be thinking about, how are you prepared? You, the individual, and you as a member of a family, you need to be taking care of your own, you know, your own nest. And one of the ways to do that is to start looking at, you know, your expenditures and where you're putting your money and, you know, how you're living. And you want to be making sure you're prepared. You know, I always remember back in the olden days, I was a Boy Scout as a kid. And it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that program. But one of the things I remember is the Boy Scout motto, it was and is, be prepared. Now, I don't know that a fourth grade boy quite understands what be prepared means, because, you know, it's a motto. And you say that and then, you run around camp in tents and canoe and have a great old time. But it's a really good motto that maybe we should be thinking about as mature adults in a very complicated global society. Be prepared. Now, how do you do that? Well, that's for you to think about. And what my goal here with this program is to take these news headlines and dissect them so that we can start to think about, what does that mean? And then how do I react to that? Okay, we know inflation's going up. All right, well, I want to be on that elevator as it's going up. I don't want to be sitting here while everything gets really, really expensive and nothing I own is going up. I don't want to be that guy. So we got to find things that you can buy that are going to ride, you know, like a rising tide floats all boats. Well, it does. It does. And, you know, I want to be in a boat. I don't want to be in the bottom of the harbor. And when the tide comes in, that's not a good place to be. You know, the same thing with retail spending. When you want to think about that, it's an indicator of the economy. The economy starts to slow down. And that goes to my lecture of yesterday, which was probably blacked out. But at the end of the day, when you have a business, it's revenues minus expenses is income or profit, okay? And you need revenues and you need to manage your expenses in such a way that that bottom line, that number at the bottom is either, you know, it's positive. You know, you want to have income is, you know, is greater than one or greater than, you know, 0.5. Because that's how we go through life. So when you see retail spending deteriorating, what that tells me is revenues are softening and companies are going to have to cut their costs. And as I mentioned yesterday, 70% of a company's cost is labor. And if you were working for somebody else and half of Americans work for big companies and the other half of Americans work for companies and the other half own their own business. If you're in a position where you're a cost, you know, you're an employee, you're a cost, you know, you might be a valuable employee, you might be a wonderful employee, we all are, I'm sure, but you're a cost. So if revenues are declining and inflation is going up, business managers have to trim their costs and your costs. So you don't want to be the guy who gets laid off because now your revenue disappears. Your expenses are still there. You still have rent, house payment, your car, your gasoline, food. You don't want to be in that situation. So my job here, my goal is to let's talk about these news stories and translate them because every news story has an agenda. I mean, this stuff pops. It doesn't just come out of the ether. Anybody who writes a news story has got an agenda. And we want to peer through that. And what does it mean for you? What does it mean for me? And that's the whole purpose of doing this show. So again, I want to thank our sponsors, Swiss America. You really ought to give them a call at 800-519-6271. Ask them for the free packet. Just, you know, it's free. Just they'll mail it out to you. You just take a good look at it. And if you have any questions, give them a call. Do your homework. And if you feel that sort of thing is right for you, silver, gold, precious metals, you know, they're good people to work with. But keep in mind, it's your responsibility to take care of yourself, to be prepared. So maybe, I don't know if you're in the Boy Scouts or not, I was, but boy, the older you get, the more you realize it's really, really important to be prepared. And this is what we're going to be talking about. So I will be back Monday. We'll find out what happens over the weekend. Hopefully, World War III doesn't start or something. We'd not like that at all. And we'll have plenty to talk about because there's one thing for certain is the economy is eternal. Every day it goes on and on and on. And we will at least be able to interpret the signals we're getting, the stories we're seeing, and figure out what we should be doing so that we can take care of ourselves. So with that, I think I'll sign off and have a great weekend. Enjoy whichever part of the country you're in. I think we're looking at a little snow here in Wisconsin, but other places are probably a lot nicer, a lot warmer. So anyway, have a great weekend, and we'll certainly talk to you soon. Take care.